Our second subject today is directly related to the first, but there's a difference of timing. We spent the first half hour talking about Oregon higher education funding for the next biennium, the two-year period starting July 1st. Over that biennium and into the next, the actual mechanisms for determining state funding campus by campus will change over to a new system. The basic idea, better money for better outcomes, more degrees, more dollars. That might be an oversimplification, so we'll get into the details with our guest. Ben Cannon is the executive director at the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission, almost universally referred to already as HEC. Hi, Ben. Thanks for joining us again.
Good morning. Thank you.
Can you give us a reminder, a refresher course, if you will, about the relationship between HEC and the campuses? Because it is a different relationship from what existed with the previous Board of Higher Education and the campuses.
Yeah, sure. The HEC, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, was created around the same time that the institutional boards for the seven campuses were created in order to help coordinate the system. Our responsibilities include approving the missions for the seven universities, their mission statements, approving new programs. So when a board, whether at a community college or a university, wants to start a new program, they come eventually to us for approval. And significantly, we decide how to allocate state funding to the seven public universities and likewise to the 17 community colleges. So we maintain the formulas that determine how state dollars, however many state dollars the legislature chooses to appropriate, get distributed to the universities and the colleges.
So here again, it is the legislature that decides the number, but the allocation decided by the HEC?
Right, and historically, those were that was a responsibility of the State Board of Higher Ed that also governed the universities. So that, you know, the really big distinction for our commission is we don't govern, we don't hire or fire presidents, we don't adopt the budgets for the campuses, we don't determine how those resources are spent, we don't micromanage in any respect the operations of the universities. Instead, we have this coordinating role. It's a lighter touch, but the funding piece is pretty significant, we're making changes to that, as you suggested.
And the governing boards, now those will all be in place by the middle of this year, so each of the seven state universities will have their own essentially local boards.
Correct. And those have been appointed, and they've begun to meet. In the case of the three large universities, OSU, U of O, and PSU, they've already had almost a year now under their belt. They're going really, really well. I think most folks consider those boards, the three large, as well as the four at the smaller universities that have been appointed but not yet really taken formal control, consider those a real success, really beginning to manage those institutions very well. The concern for many state legislators and others was that we not lose the sense of having a real coordinated system, that it's important for students to know that they can transfer seamlessly between institutions, that we maintain certain kinds of economies of scale, that we don't over-duplicate within our higher education system, and that we have a kind of rational basis for making policy and funding decisions for our universities and community colleges.
In the three major campuses that already have the local governing boards actually operating and essentially in command, are there changes already that in the ways they do things?
Yeah, I mean, these boards have been much more, how shall I say, I mean, I think they're much more direct in their oversight, much more involved in their oversight of the institutions. We saw at U of O, famously, the new board, only a couple of months after taking control almost a year ago, decided to make a change in the presidency there, and they've just recently now announced the appointment of a new president. So that's a very direct and sort of obvious way in which the new board became quickly involved in is setting the institution on a course that it thinks most appropriate for the institution and for the community. I would say, U of O is a bit of a unique case because of it has such a national and international profile. I think in the case particularly of the smaller universities, including Southern, what these new boards will bring is a community tie, a community connection that is more prominent in the governance of the institutions than we had when Southern and the other six were governed out of a board that was, you know, primarily sort of a Portland-Salem based board. And I think that's going to have significant benefits for the institutions. I still very early in this, obviously, but I do think that's going to be quite a positive thing.
So you're saying there was a sense of remoteness being detached from the folks back at the campus?
Yeah, that's right, and especially for our regional universities, that community connection is so important. It's a big part of their reason for being. And so to have a governing board that includes community leaders, business leaders, education leaders from the region, as well as from around the state, they're not exclusively from the Rogue Valley area, for example, in Southern, but many of them are, and I think that will have significant benefits and improve the likelihood that the university is really connected to the community and serving the community.
Ben Cannon is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the Executive Director of Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Committee, or HEC. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the structure of HEC and the new structure among the state universities and the funding change that we're about to talk about. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So what was the impetus for looking for a different mechanism by which to divide up the funding?
Yeah, well, it was connected in part to the governance changes that I've described. So as the state took its hands off the universities by creating more, providing them each with local kind of governing authority, there was a concern and a desire, both on the institution's part and on the part of state policymakers, to ensure that our funding, one of the sort of remaining tools the state had for coordinating the system, that our funding was really connected to state goals and state priorities. Historically, public universities in Oregon have received funding based pretty much exclusively on their enrollment, which of course makes some sense. Larger schools should receive more through the distribution formula than smaller ones, and they will continue to do so. But what we proposed was to shift a portion of that funding to outcomes, to degree completion, so that institutions would compete for dollars not merely on enrollment, that they could also gain benefits through the formula by improving degree completion. And so while we're taking our hands off how institutions are governed, how they're run, what investments they make at a campus level to improve outcomes for students, that's really the role of the governing boards and the institutional leaders to determine. We are saying, as a state, that we're going to put our state dollar behind institutions that are really improving those outcomes, and that will be a part of the incentive structure and the reward structure for those institutions.
Okay, so you say a part of it, a portion of it. It's not entirely devoted to outcomes?
No, when this change is fully phased in, about 60% of the state funding will follow outcomes, another 40% enrollment, and even that's a bit of an oversimplification because the first thing we do is carve off about 20 or 25% for a base, and that's really significant, especially for the smaller schools because it's overweighted to smaller schools in order to help sustain their operations, understanding that they have fewer benefits of economies of scale. It's more expensive on a per-student basis to operate a university on a smaller campus. So, but 60-40 is sort of how we've talked about the state dollar. It's really, it's important for your listeners to understand, and I'm sure many of them do, that the state dollar itself is only now 20% of the total revenues, if you will, for institutions, the seven public universities. The other 80%. Being primarily tuition dollars. So the states, which will continue, of course, to be enrollment-based. So of that 20% that the state is responsible for, so we've gotten down, unfortunately, to just that amount. It's a little higher at the smaller universities, but 20% across the system. Of that, the majority will eventually, within 4 or 5 years, be focused on outcomes.
The figure is actually lower than 20% at some of the bigger schools, isn't it? Didn't I see 13% or 12% at the University of Oregon?
Yeah, you see different numbers because it depends on sort of what you count and the extent to which you include in there. Athletics, for example, which the state has no role in funding, and other auxiliary sort of services and programs. But yes, I mean, system-wide, it's about 20. At the larger schools at UVO and OSU, it's less, and at Southern, Eastern, Western, it's more.
Now, Ben Cannon, the formula is described as complicated. What are the various parts? We got so you got the numbers of degrees conferred, but there are lots of other moving parts, it sounds like.
Well, it really is. The outcomes piece really is organized around degree completion, and that's degrees of at all levels, so bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, PhDs, and that's the sole basis for determining the outcomes portion. We do, however, weight those degrees differently in a couple of ways. One is by level. So, 4-year degrees versus master's and PhDs, they're weighted differently. They have different durations associated with them. They also have different costs associated with them. Another way that we weight these degrees, and this is really important to a successful kind of outcomes-based formula, is by student type, and we put extra weights around degree completion for underrepresented students. That includes rural students, underrepresented minority students, low-income students. That's really significant because what we don't want to do is create an incentive for institutions to serve those students who are the easiest to serve or the most likely to succeed. And so we put pretty significant funding weight behind those categories. I mentioned also veteran students, the intent is to ensure that universities really continue to or even increase their focus on serving populations that are really important and are can be more challenging to serve. Finally, we also have certain targeted degree fields or degree types that are of particular demand in the economy, and one can expect that these might change over time. The commission would adjust these over time, but they include STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math degrees that will put additional weight behind. The preparation of bilingual educators, people to work in our K-12 schools, but in bilingual classrooms, so we're putting extra weight behind those. And healthcare fields, in such demand, healthcare degrees in such a demand all over the state, I know in Southern Oregon. And we'll put extra weight as well behind those. So there's weighting, essentially it's degrees, but with various weights depending on cost as well as student type as well as the demand for the degree within the economy.
We're talking to Ben Cannon at the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. He's the executive director. We're talking about new funding mechanisms for higher education in the state of Oregon, essentially more outcome-based as the years go on. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area by email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Ben, are there speed incentives too? In other words, if they get out in 4 years, that's worth more to the university?
Yes, although it's not direct, but that is the consequence of the formula we've adopted. So essentially, for the outcomes portion of this, the amount of time to degree does not matter for the payment. So from a state funding standpoint, the payment to the institution is the same, irrespective or regardless of whether the time to degree was 4 years or 6 years. That, we think, and the institutions have told us, means they have an incentive to help that student complete in less time rather than more. That incentive does not exist today under the old formula, an enrollment-based one, where payments for a student who's taking 5, 6, 7 years are identical to one who's, in their third or fourth. So I think this is a pretty important feature of a formula, particularly in an era when, we hear about many students who are taking 5, 6 years, sometimes by choice and necessity, sometimes because the course they need isn't available. And frankly, from a state funding standpoint, the institution doesn't necessarily have a direct financial incentive to make that course available and support that student to completion. Part of this is, a lot of this, I would say, is about guidance and counseling, coaching, mentoring of students to help them make appropriate choices for for them to complete in a timely way. And again, the hope and the expectation is that this formula helps create rewards and supports for institutions to invest in that guidance, coaching, counseling, mentoring, wraparound services, making sure students can get to campus if they're living farther away. So that's the hope with what we're doing.
But in some cases, you're probably going to have students whose life circumstances are beyond really the powers of the university to influence, aren't you? I mean, people who have to leave school for a couple of years because a parent died or something, and they have to help out at home, and then can come back to campus, those sorts of situations?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we completely understand that there are many students whose circumstances and reasons for not completing or for taking longer to complete are outside of institutions' control and will continue to be outside of their control. But we would also submit that there are many students who, if provided better coaching, counseling, support, and some of that's financial, but it comes in other forms too, could complete in less time rather than more, could get the extra tutoring or counseling if it was made available, if they were really sought after by faculty and administrators on campus, and if the institutions had the dollars to put into that. When we asked the seven public universities a year ago what they would do with more dollars if the state was better funding them, where would they put those dollars? They had different ideas on each campus, but the common theme was investments in supports for students to help see them through to completion. That the counseling center, that the tutoring support, that the coaching they would invest in was a priority, and we're trying to create. While we don't control how many dollars the state puts into the system overall, that's a legislative decision. We're trying to ensure that the distribution mechanism does help support and reward those kinds of campus level investments.
We're talking to Ben Cannon on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the executive director at the HEC, the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We're talking about the funding mechanisms for the state universities over the next several years. It'll phase in over 4 years, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, starting this year.
We have a good question here from Scott in Ashland, who wonders, if a student begins her education at SOU and completes her degree at U of O, does SOU get any credit under the new system? If not, doesn't it unfairly disadvantage SOU?
Yeah, so That is a great question, and SOU would continue to get enrollment-based and, of course, tuition funding for that student. U of O would not receive the full outcomes payment, so we have calibrated it to some extent for transfer students, so an institution that's only responsible for the final couple of years of the student's enrollment wouldn't receive the full payment. And I think there will be a continuing conversation about the extent to which an institution that's responsible for the transfer, the first couple of years, would receive funding for the successful transfer and ultimate completion. This comes up a lot, not only around students like the type your listener identified transferring from Southern to University of Oregon, but also community colleges where we're working on similar changes, and they send so many transfer students to our public universities, and certainly the commission believes that should be rewarded and encouraged by funding models. So I'd identify that as an area for ongoing consideration.
And that was the other shoe about what happens to community colleges, and you just answered that one. Is it true that by the change in the funding mix, Portland State University with a large non-trad, large minority, large veteran population comes out pretty well?
That seems likely. You know, anything that we say about who comes out ahead really requires a lot of assumption making and speculation, because it will depend on their actual enrollment and completion numbers over the years. But PSU, as for some of the reasons that you identified, and because of some ways in which they seemed to have been sort of structurally disadvantaged under the old enrollment formula, really some technical reasons for that, probably will end up coming out ahead. But like I say, that we're really excited about the kind of innovation that we hope to see, and some of it, you know, innovation that we can't possibly predict at a campus level to help take advantage of the incentives and rewards and supports within this new formula. I met with Southern's president, Dr. Saigo, and incoming board chair, Bill Thorndike, just earlier this week, and heard from them the excitement and opportunity they feel around making campus-level investments really focused on supporting students to completion. And I don't know exactly what those will be, but they understand that enrolling and completing particularly underrepresented students will have a significant payoff for them within the funding system, and really looking forward to seeing that work.
I asked this a lot about the policy choices made, whether this was already in use to great effect in some other place, and it was essentially something you could pull off the shelf and implement in Oregon.
Yeah, it is in use in other places, although our particular approach isn't identical to any other state, but a number of states have embarked on this path, some less successfully, some more successfully. Some of our lessons included that to do this, you really need to do it. You can't simply just take a couple million dollars and put it in a performance bonus pot and say, okay, the institution that improves its graduation rates the most is going to get a $1 million prize. I mean, that's been what some states have attempted to do in the name of performance funding or outcomes funding. States that appear to be more successful with this have implemented it more holistically. They've stuck with it. They've included significant weights around underrepresented students, as I've described, and they've taken very seriously the concerns and the criticisms that get raised about it. And we're trying to do that too.
And fully implemented in Oregon in 4 years, is that right?
Yes.
Over the next two biennia. All right, Ben Cannon is the executive director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We've been talking about the changes to the funding mechanisms for Oregon State universities and community colleges. Ben, thanks so much for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great. Glad to be there.
Take care.